Would the Spartacus have become if they succeeded in their aim and taken over? Almost impossible. But if they had done, would they have become with the Bolsheviks? Would they have suppressed all opposition and behaved in the way that the Bolsheviks did in Russia? Well, I think there's no alternative for them to do that. I mean, any group that gets power undemocratically can only hold on to it undemocratically. If they somehow or other force themselves into a position where they become the ruling group, then they cannot expect to get, nor will they get, the support of the majority of the population. And the only way they can hold on to power is by suppressing their opponents, whatever direction that opposition comes from. About Rosa Luxemburg's understanding of how capitalism works. Well, I think she had a fairly sound understanding of the basic case, which is incidentally all I've got. But the point I was making in my talk was that she acted against it when the time came to the practice. That's as far as a materialist conception of history goes. Now, on her understanding of the economics of capitalism, well, I think that probably would be her weakest point. She did swallow, hook, line, and sinker, this idea that capitalism could collapse. This is a thing that runs all through her writing, certainly all the writings of her that I have read. Quite frankly, I've never read her major economic work, The Accumulation of Capital. To understand it, the real bias. On the question of a support for a general strike, well, again, I would say she was wrong there. She saw the general strike as being a tremendous weapon. But surely, a general strike carried out by the working class involves a working class that is not ready for socialism because it's got all sorts of different political ideas. I mean, workers have got every kind of political idea under the sun. Some of them, in this country for example, are members of the Labour Party or are supporters of the Labour Party. Very few of them members of the Labour Party. And if they are, it's usually because they want to gain admission to the drinking den in the local Labour club. But anyway, supporters of the Labour Party, supporters of the Tory Party, supporters of the Alliance, supporters of the various nationalist parties, and so on and so forth. Some are even men supporters of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. But the point is, we've got all these different ideas. Now, it's awfully unlikely that they're all going to come together for a political purpose which compromises a general strike. That's what a general strike is for, usually, certainly in the terms of Rosa Luxemburg was talking about it. It's not to bring a gain from the capitalist class in the form of goods and conditions, it's to accelerate the demand of the capital system. So we don't think that a general strike can never be successful, certainly not in a political sense, for the reason that the participants in the proposed general strike don't have the same political ideas. And that's why the miners' strike collapsed in the way that it did. Because a hell of a lot of miners, although they might have been supporters of the Labour Party, a hell of a lot of them weren't. And even a lot of them who were supporters of the Labour Party took the viewpoint that a strike, a political strike to bring down a government, that's not the job of a union. In many cases, they weren't even in favour of that. They don't think that's the way that a government should be replaced. So the chances of a general strike succeeding a sore remote, if they're not worth bothering about. Rosa Luxemburg is probably an example of your typical would-be revolutionary who lays down all the rules as to how workers should behave without having any direct experience of it. Now, how often have we come across youngsters in various left-wing organisations to have a completely fairy tale conception of what it's like in a factory, because they've never worked in one. I was reading an article about 3 weeks ago there in the Guardian. It was written by Tony Clifford, the Socialist Party, and it was about why Labour lost the election. And one of the points he raised is one that's a recurring theme with Tony Clifford. He sees shop stewards as the salt of the earth. He sees them as the revolutionary vanguard. Now that can only be for one of two reasons. One, that he's completely daft, or the other one, that he's never ever been in a factory. I mean, I've worked all my life in factories. I've had experience of shop stewards from the age of 17. And apart from being the revolutionary vanguard that the left wing see them as, and here's they are. Sugar and useful bastards, not to put too fine a point on it. A lot of them do it, and now they've got a foreman's job, or a rain fixer's job. That's a very, very common first step on the ladder, incidentally, is to get a shop steward job. I've actually had shop stewards. Well, the last but one in the place I was in, a revolutionary, he calls black people jungle bunnies. I stood beside a shop steward when men were being taken on. There was a bit of a big order to be fulfilled, and a lot of guys were turning up at the factory office to get interviewed for jobs. And I've actually overheard the shop steward at that time say to one of his cronies, "I'll have to make sure none of those Catholic bastards get in." So that's the kind of people who do shop steward jobs. Some of them are the salt of the earth, by the way. In fact, the best shop steward I ever experienced was a guy who was an anarchist. A little guy in Glasgow who ran rings around the management. He got us the best rate for a job in the whole of Clydeside. And I've got nothing but admiration for him. How few and far between people like that are. Usually shop stewards are either opportunists or thunderheads.
With regard to Rosa Luxemburg, there are now views on my kind of thought, which is probably you have to put a label on it, like metaphysical lunacy. I think last month, lunacy actually happened. There was a heat wave in Greece. And a million people managed for a couple of days, albeit a few days, evacuate our civilized society. When the news reports went about to find them, there was no human society. So, what I want to know is Rosa Luxemburg's view on this. Karl Marx, or any of these Marxist, socialist, Leninist, communist, or whatever you want to call them. Because they all seem to take a view that we've got to remain within society, and what we need is some form of new form of society to be organized, because the way this society is operating is not all organized properly. What we need is a system. What we need is a new system, for society to be organized. I would take the route, basically, that society is not really worth bothering with, and we should do, what these million people in Athens did. Just for a few days, managed to escape it. Because everywhere I go, there seems to be a lull into proceedings. For example, you ask the Islamic speakers, down in Hyde Park, they're all there down there. I mean, they're talking about some form of God, will be organising and running, and he'll be looking after you. You can imagine that. And, I wonder if I think I am a lunatic, because it is beyond me. Because the reply that I get back is, you're these different people. These million people in Athens managed to break the chains of our society that's constrained around us. is in fact enforced upon us. How did they manage to do that for 4 or 5 days? All right, they came back again to reality. But for the 4 or 5 days, they managed to have some form of lunacy. How do you account for this 4 or 5 days of utopia, as far as I'm concerned? How do you, or even Rosa Luxemburg, what would she say on this? What would her instructions be to work?
Well, we'll never have a sea on swell to call up Rosa Luxemburg. No, I don't know what Rosa Luxemburg's views have on that. And incidentally, I don't even know to any extent what was going on in Greece during that recent heatwave. What I do know about it is that apart from society's collapsing, actually it carried on pretty much as before. Society organised itself. Broadcasts were made over the media, advising people what to do, how to escape the worst excesses of this incredible heat. Human beings still cooperated. Whenever somebody had to be taken to hospital or get medical attention of some kind, then there was people there to do that. But even supposing it was true that the majority opted out of society for a couple of days, well, the contributor answered it himself. He said, okay, they've got to come back to reality sometime, and that's it. I mean, we kind of all do what we, some of us at any rate, apparently did in places like Athens, just fly back for a few days and never go to work, just be consumers rather than producers. I mean, obviously, human beings in any society cannot exist for long like that. Sooner or later, usually sooner than later, they've got to go back to producing the things society needs. And of course, that is what happened as soon as the great heat wave was over. And that's for the, that's not lunacy, that's for the credit of the humankind that they do that. And the long may continue. What I want them to do it on is a different basis. I want them to cooperate with one another, not in the running of capitalism. I want them to cooperate with one another, not to make a handful rich as they do today, while they and the millions that like them, they live lives of relative poverty. I want them to organise to put an end to the lunacy of the capitalist system, because it is a lunacy. It's a system that doesn't satisfy the needs of the vast majority. It plunges them into wars that they don't want. It plunges them into insecurity that they fear. It plunges them into conflict, which again, well, with the exception of a few skinheads, none of them want. And that's the kind of society capitalism is. So I have the utmost confidence that this desire to continue in a civilised way, as was demonstrated during the Great Heat Wave in Greece, will continue to manifest itself. But when we get that political revolution that we've been talking about added on to that, then we'll get it carried out in a sane way. Then we'll have a sane society for the first time in history, well, at any rate, for the first time for a hell of a long time.
That is a speaker.
I'm not suggesting that we all need to have it at the one time. That we
don't. Speak up!
But
speak up!
Yeah. When you talk about Rosa Luxemburg's thought on revolution coming about through a general strike, what would your view or the view of the Social Party be on that? Understanding that, that at the present, at the present time, trade unions and shop stewards are not politically, are not socialist conscious. But political change, would organisation of society, how will this sort of change come about? How will this revolution come about if it is not through sort of like direct action by the conscious working class? What is the view of the Social Party on this, or how is this revolutionary change going to come about? Is it going to come about directly through a ballot box, or will it come about through from the practical side as well, as workers taking action against the state of the score, the present organization?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we take the viewpoint that it'll come about when a majority, first of all, understand it and are in favour of it. When that situation comes, there'll be no need for them to go on a general strike. What would be the point of them striking against their employers whenever all they've got to do is to say, right, I've had enough, we're going to abolish you lot, and we're going to institute a new society based on our interests. That's the first thing. They don't have to have a general strike. They will introduce the new society democratically. And you can only do that when you've got a majority. Now, how do you know you've got a majority? Well, of course, we could maybe rely on vague notions. We could maybe rely on the word of mouth, things like that. But we think the best way of finding out what the majority are thinking at any particular time is the old time honoured one of counting noses. I mean, it'd be crazy for a large minority, albeit of socialists, who think wrongly that they've now got a majority, to try and take over while the majority were actually not in favour of socialism. They would be suppressed. Just the same as today, if a minority tried to take power, it wouldn't be the capitalist class who would have put them down. It would be members of the working class in the state machine who would be doing it. They would say, well, we can't have this. This is society breaking down in chaos. This is the something that's got to be put an end to. So we say it will be brought about democratically. And the best way to find out whether we've got a majority or not is through the ballot box. Now, quite frankly, neither I nor any other member of the Socialist Party knows what other action will be taken. I just don't know. I can't see, for example, workers in one factory taking independent action to seize that factory. Well, I don't know. To seize that factory against the background of a situation where you've not got a majority. And if I've got a majority, why do they have to act in this individualistic way? There'd be no need for them to do that. It will be abundantly clear, we think, when enough people, we'll have the media informing us all the time, we'll have our own intelligence informing us all the time of the growth of socialist ideas throughout the world. And there will come a time, surely, unless we fly in the face of all science and decide that capitalism is going to last forever, nothing is ever than that, we will be able to tell pretty accurately when we've got a majority. But to avoid any mistake, to avoid any error, which just might put back the socialist revolution for years, will confirm that impression by finding out what the majority viewpoint is for or against.
Sorry, I think what I meant really was not suggesting that a general strike would actually, that would actually sort of be the forces that take place, bring about the revolution. Of course, if we're suggesting that that By taking control and owning the means of production, that obviously we might be aware of the fact that we are in a majority. We are a majority of socialist consciousness. But the thing about it is that if we're still living under capitalism, we've got to be aware, come to terms with the situation where we own the means of production. We are actually we're in the factory where we no longer work for a boss. We get to that situation where we say that the revolution has occurred.
Yeah. You want to know the mechanism?
Yes. We got to the stage where we're the majority of socialist workers. Where do we go from there?
Well, the first thing we'll do in the parliaments throughout the world, just to legalise it, the socialist majority send its delegates to the various parliaments throughout the world and declare illegal the private ownership of the means of life. That will be the end of capitalism. Now, about the nuts and bolts of it, well, I think it's a very simple matter to organise society's production of wealth on a production for use basis. I don't see any point. All we need to do is to remove the restrictions that the private property setup places on us doing that. And I'm sure the contributor must be aware that the problems in production today are not natural ones. They're ones imposed by the limitations of private property. That only enough wealth can be produced as is suitable for the profit motive. You must be aware of that. Now, let's just prevent intelligent men and women who, after all, today run society from top to bottom. I mean, it's not the capitalists that run the various undertakings. They've got other fish to fry. They've got other things to do with their time, usually float about in yachts, chase chorus girls around the table, and generally live the life of Riley. They pay highly paid workers to run their enterprises for them. And make no mistake about that, those people who are described as executives today are highly paid workers. And whenever they get their books, it's happened from time to time. I read about one recently down in the City of London, a disagreement with the chairman of the board. Guess who had to go? And Monday morning, or the following Monday, or the one after that, he's looking for a new employer, just as if he'd been a sweeper-upper in a factory or whatever. So all the enterprises within capitalism are run by people like you and I. London Transport, an incredibly complicated business. Try and imagine all the work involved in that. All the mechanical side of it, all the business of working out the routes and the timetables, and so on and so forth. Done from beginning to end by members of the working class. And that applies everything. So what about then those people who are already doing that, but with the burden of private property around their neck, freed from that burden, continue to do it, only on a more efficient basis. And that will happen in the factories. That will happen in the production of food. See, there's a thing today called market research. I'm sure everybody in this room is aware of it, where they try to find out what the requirements of the market will be in any particular commodity. And men and women who usually, a lot of them at any rate, with very good degrees, a lot of intelligence and education, trying to work out, you know, how many pairs of shoes of a certain size and the model will be required next year, or a better one. How many package holidays will be required every year? And everybody here, they get it wrong. This year, there's about twice as many holidays available as the market wants. Nothing sure that come the winter, they'll decide, oh, okay, we'll not get caught with all those holidays on our hands again. We'll cut the number by 20-30% of that. Next summer, you'll not be able to get a bloody holiday. They'll all be booked up. They can't tell what the market's going to do. It's impossible. But nevertheless, sometimes they get it right. Sometimes they're calculating right. Now, could we not have something in a society called needs research? But you're not trying to blindly find out what the answers are in a market economy and all the pitfalls that places on your path. We could just have a needs research and we'd find out exactly, with a bit left over for safety's sake, how much food we need, how much clothing, how much housing. There's no problem. As a matter of fact, today, you've got certain agencies that are part of the United Nations organisation They're doing that. They say, right, next year, so much food will be required to keep the population of, say, West Africa fed, and so on and so forth. And even if they get their sums right, it's an academic exercise, because most of those people in West Africa don't have that thing called effective demand. They've not got the money, perhaps, to pay for the food that everybody knows that they need. So I don't see that socialism is going to be any problem at all. I think it's going to be like a situation where today you go up to a workman and they say, I'd like a hole dug there. There's the shovel. Just wait a minute, hang on, I'm going to tie your hands behind your back. Get on with it. I think it's socialism, and that's what it's like in capitalism. People are hindered from doing all the things that are necessary. I've got, metaphorically speaking, their hands tied behind their back. Now, in socialism, those bonds will be cut free. You'll be able to get on with the job, freed of the restrictions of private property, the market economy, and all the rest of it. I think humanity is an incredibly ingenious, inventive, productive, hard-working entity. Freed of the private property restrictions, the problem was seen as nothing.
Well, just to come back again on that, the other point, but I think I am a lunatic, but with regard to the factory, we've been talking about a lot about the factory and the should we have a general strike? I mean, I didn't hear it right, but are we going to have a general strike to remain in the factory so we can take the shackles of the chains that's been placed on our bosses, and we're going to pen ourselves in there so we can organise society away from our bosses, like we'll still be in the factory? I mean, can you imagine it? All of us still remaining in transport, all of us still doing the factories and all these other utilities, all artificialities of civilization, still all there. The only difference is that the bosses have disappeared. I mean, what I'm trying to say is how did man cope for 15 million years or half a million years without all of these artificial utilities in civilization? How did he manage to cope? Now, I've heard it all before about, our social scientist, our friend, where he says that if you put man on his own and, there'll be this and there'll be that. I'm not talking about we're going to put any man on his own. What I'm talking about is getting rid of this dream. When you're talking about a factory, the transport systems, the barracks, all of these things share a common organisation. It's possible you can restrict the whole of the individual's time and space, hour by hour, minute by minute, second by second. What you've got is a well-oiled mechanical machine of human beings giving their power to some form of illusion. Now, how do we break out of this chain? Do we run out? Do we evacuate? Do we transform it? It's all very well getting rid of our bosses. It's all very well. Not while remaining in it, we've got rid of the bosses and we're still doing all this, running around in it like that. I work for London Transport, so I know what it's like. And I'm any future form of human revolution, if you can call it that. I won't be doing London transport. I'll be living in the hills somewhere.
Yeah, that's all very good. That's very valid. And I'm glad that the last contributor raised that point. Because it doesn't need to be cleared up. No question about that. What he's suggesting, as you all heard, is that are we going to live the same kind of life in socialism as we live in capitalism? Well, as many of us be herded into factories or onto London Transport or British Rail or whatever. And the plain answer to that one is no, there's absolutely no need for that. I would say that the vast majority of jobs that are done within capitalism today are useful only inside capitalism. That in a socialist society, they would not be needed. I mean, think of the armies of people who are employed and doing jobs which would be redundant inside a society of common ownership. London Transport, for example, all those inspectors who check up to see whether people have paid their fare or whether the conductors have fiddled some of the money that's been collected. And that's a big industry, by the way, Robin London Transport. I know a bit about that. And so on and so forth. Think of all those people down in the City of London. I don't know how many of them are, in those banks, in those pension funds, in those unit trusts, in those investment funds, in those places where they buy and sell shares and so on and so forth. All of it absolutely useless in a socialist society. All of these useful and intelligent human beings will be released to do, if they wish, some useful, productive work. And again, it's not without the bounds of a human ken for human beings to get together in a place where they work and organise it to suit their needs and to suit the needs of society. They're not going to be running it the way they do it today. They do it today in order to satisfy the requirements of the profit system. Now, I hope I'm getting that across. And the one about how did people survive for all those millions of years before we came on to modern society and so on. Well, the short answer to that one is not very well. I mean, they usually had a very, very short life expectation. They were subject to all sorts of diseases and usually half-starved.
Not true.
Oh, but it is true. It is true. I'm sorry, but if you don't agree with that, but it is true. Make no mistake about that. There's no need for us to live like that. There's no need for us to live like that any more than there is a need for us to continue the practices of work inside capitalist society, inside a socialist society. We can live the kind of lives that we want to. If human beings don't want to produce as much as is produced today, then they'll decide to do that. In my personal needs, for example, and remember what I said in my talk, socialism will mean from each according to the ability to each according to the needs. No matter my personal needs, well, at present, they're pretty well satisfied just now. I never go hungry, fortunately. I've got enough clothes, a pair of pants, a shirt, and a pair of shoes on my feet, and in winter time, a coat on my back. That usually suffices for me. I don't want to dress up like a dog's dinner, the way the capitalist class do. That to me is daft. They only do that, incidentally. And they're working class imitators. The capitalist class do it to make out, to make clear rather, that they're different from you. And the working class imitators, of course, they do it in order to ape their masters. So my requirements are few and simple. I'm not going to want people to get into factories and churn out billions of pairs of trousers. One or two pair will do me, and I'm sure that will apply to the rest of you. We'll get what we want. We'll organise society's production in line with the requirements of the rest of us. But obviously, we're going to have to transport. I mean, here we've got the world's our oyster. At last, the fruit that has been there for the plucking has been plucked. I'm wanting to enjoy that world. I'm not going to want to be stuck in Glasgow for the rest of my life. I'm wanting to see the rest of the world. Good heavens, I can to a great extent I can do it today. I'm certainly going to want to do it more than in a socialist society. So there will have to be transport. People will have to grow food. Now, I think it'd be daft for us all to go back in time in all of our own little bit of land and all try to grow enough food just to feed ourselves. I'm pretty sure, based on my experiences in the garden of the house that I used to live in, that I wouldn't do too well. So I think that there are people who are very good at it, and incidentally, like doing it. And it's an old cliche, but it happens to be true that one man's meat is another man's poison. Now, my idea of hell is getting put onto a farm and having to work in the land. But there's a hell of a lot of people love working on the land. I saw an interview on television recently. It was a deal with the Conservative Party's, the Conservative government's plans to revolutionise the use of land in Britain. What they've been saying is, look, far too much food getting produced in Britain. That's in a situation where there's millions starving all over the world. What they're saying is, we've got all these food mountains in the common market. What we're doing is the capitalist class, remember. We're subsidising these farmers to produce food that can't be sold at a profit. They're getting around, at long last, to kicking their most consistent supporters in the teeth. What they're saying to farmers now is, look, the gravy paying train has come to a stop. You're going to have to go off. You're going to have to do something else with that land rather than grow food on it. You can grow trees on it, perhaps, as an opportunity there for forestry. Or you can turn your land over for what they call the leisure industry, you know, amusement parks and so on and so forth. And an interview I saw with various farmers, and they were asked why they wanted to stay in the land, and they said, because I like the life. They like the life. So I'm pretty sure that in a socialist society there will be people who will want to continue working on the land to produce the food the society needs. But they won't be doing it for a market economy and all that that implies. They'll be doing it in order to feed all the empty bellies all over the world. Just the same as if we want to travel, and if it comes down to it, and I want to see the world, and nobody is prepared to do the necessary work of transporting me, well, people like me are going to have to get together and work something out. We're going to have to decide, we're going to have to learn to fly or to sail a ship or something like that. Like, human beings are intelligent people, not dunderheads. You've got to get rid of this idea that what we're proposing is that we just take capitalism as it is and carry on as before, but with a few modifications. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a revolution, a complete transformation, not only in the way that wealth is produced, but how it's distributed. Now, I'm sorry, cannot give you a detailed blueprint of what we're going to do. I don't know enough. But I'm pretty sure that collectively we know enough.
Yeah, incidentally, I hope that this speaker has more than one pair of hands. Yeah, it is popping. Yeah, more than
that. Can you speak up a bit?
Stop it, yeah. Yeah, right. Yes, returning to Rosa Luxemburg, would the couldn't speak to comment on whether she held similar ideas to the Socialist Party regarding what we believe socialism to be, what socialism is, what we...
Oh yeah, well, unfortunately I've not brought all the bumps that I have on Rosa Luxemburg with me, but This little pamphlet here is easy to carry. And she's talking about the final goal, socialism, the conquest of political power and the suppression of wage labour. Now, she was very clear about what socialism would involve. And incidentally, why shouldn't she? At that time in history, everybody who thought of himself or herself as a socialist shared our viewpoint. You know, the one I always use is this excerpt from a party pamphlet where it deals with this proposition. How widely held was the SPGB's view at the tail end of the last century? And they quote this example in something called the Manifesto of English Socialists. Now, was issued jointly in 1893 by the Fabian Society, and even they call them the closet SDGDers, the Social Democratic Federation and the Hammersmith Social Society. The signatories including William Morris, George Bernard Shaw, H.M. Hyndman and Sidney Webb were able to agree on the following declaration, which appeared in the manifesto. On this point, all socialists agree. Our aim, one and all, is to obtain for the whole community complete ownership and control of the means of transport, the means of manufacture, the mines and the land. Thus we look to put an end forever to the wage system, to sweep away all distinctions of class, and eventually to establish international communism on a sound basis. And even Keir Hartley chipped in. You couldn't call him a raven red revolutionary. He said that his objective was free communism in which the rule of life will be from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. So it was widely held that whatever differences they had in the social democratic movement in the world, almost all of them were united on that proposition, what socialism would entail. Unfortunately, it pretty soon got sidetracked up the blind alley of reforms. But, you know, I think it's indicative that if somebody like Keir Hardy can hold that viewpoint, then I think we can put our money on it that Rosa Luxemburg would have that viewpoint too, and she did. It was a viewpoint that was generally held throughout the social democratic movement in the world.
Can I just come in on this? Because, you know, I don't want to go into historical nitpicking, but this is one that has got on my nerves for long enough. This manifesto of English socialists was, why don't we get the full quotation of everything that was in that for a start? Secondly, Shaw, writing about that just a few months later, said that he'd only put his signature to it without even reading it. I would say Hyndman was never a socialist. No way a socialist. And the Socialist Party has persistently peddled this myth that Hyndman was a socialist. And it really shouldn't. It really is a bloody total distortion of history. Hyndman was a nationalist. He believed in the British Empire, strong navy. He was a racist. In the First World War, he shot people to the police for refusing to fight, even leaving one woman anti-war resistor to be sent into a police cell and made to take a shower, followed by using a towel which had just been used by a prostitute with VD, which eventually killed her, all as a result of Hyndman. So how the Socialist Party can maintain that these people have got something to do with socialism on the basis of one paragraph, where you'll notice there are three dots where a vital passage is left out. And this has been repeated in several pamphlets. And although I've mentioned this to people in the past, you know, frankly, if we're gonna be arguing this, it's just nonsense. And secondly, you didn't answer the question. I'm not blaming you for not doing that, because you didn't have the information, as you said. You know, you've only got the one pamphlet and the one pair of pants. But nevertheless, there is a point that Rosa Luxemburg's view on socialism was not spelled out. I mean, where does Rosa Luxemburg talk about the basics of socialism? You know, not just broad terms, but, you know, a society where there are no wages, where people work according to their ability, take according to their need, the implications of this, a moneyless society, free access. William Morris did. Marx, we can say, to a greater extent did, although we know the arguments and problems about that, but Rosa Luxemburg didn't, and but that's not really why I came in. That is, in my view, what you should have said about Rosa Luxemburg. But on that manifesto of English socialists, it's really got on my nerves for a long time that we keep peddling that myth. The only thing I would agree historically is that at the beginning of the century, there was a greater degree of agreement about what socialism meant, which we could all, and I think that was a great thing. But even there were the state capitalists, there were the socialists. That's the same today, only it's more confused. I'll agree with you there. But that one is a non-starter.
Well,
I don't think we can argue about what was read there as a whatever else was said before it and said after it, what was read there certainly conveys to me the impression that these people, whatever their differences with us, did share that basic viewpoint. Now, about Hyndman, I'm astonished to hear that the Socialist Party of Great Britain ever claimed that Hyndman was a socialist. I know of no instance in party literature or from any party speaker until tonight that socialism, the SPGB regarded Hyndman as a socialist. From the word go, they berated him, they hammered him, they abused him, they poured every approbation on him that they could think of. They've only got to read the obituary in the Socialist Standard that was printed when Hyndman died in the 1930s. I had occasion to read it quite recently there. And again, no punches were pulled about where the Socialist Party stood in relation to Hyndman. They recognised him for what he was, an egotistical, reformist, political trickster. But the only thing they had to say about him in his favour was, well, at least they helped make the works of Marx more readily available in Great Britain, and it helped publicise them. So if that constitutes an endorsement for Hyndman as a socialist, well, I don't think it does. If it does, then as far as I'm concerned, I speak an entirely different language from the last contributor. No, I don't think the Socialist Party has ever been guilty of that. Can't emphasise that strongly enough.
It says quite clearly in Questions of the Day that it doesn't use exactly these words, but it says that the SDF fancied itself as a socialist organisation. Hyndman regarded it as his own personal possession, and Engels was living in the time that in London at the time that it existed, and he would have nothing to do with it.
I believe that in the rules of the Labour Party in Clause 4, they mentioned something also about the ownership on the floor, commonly owned as well. That is anything we can judge like the socialists or thinkers at the time to be socialists. I mean, By that being put into the rules of the Labour Party, it doesn't seem to indicate that the founder members of the Labour Party were socialists.
Well, what the last contributor is referring to is the Clause 4 of the Labour Party, which wasn't incidentally formulated until several years after the Labour Party was formed. It was formed in 1906. Clause 4 was adopted, I think, at its 1917 conference. But to paraphrase it, what it says, that the aim of the Labour Party is to secure by hand and by brain the full fruits of the means of production, distribution and change. Now, okay, we are in favour of the means of production and distribution to commonly owned. We say that all the time. But how in the name of having common ownership of the means of exchange? What are the means of exchange? There's the means of exchange. I've got a couple of quid in my back pocket here which I could show you. That's the means of exchange. It's something that's used between owners and non-owners to circulate commodities. Now, how can we own the means of exchange in common? We can't. We're going to get all the money and divide it up among us all completely equally. And if we did, what would that achieve? Now, obviously, you cannot have exchange in society, in socialist society. That's a contradiction. In terms, socialism means the end of exchange relationships, because it means the end of owners and non-owners, the wealth of society will be commonly owned. And there'll be no place in a socialist society for these coins and rectangular bits of paper. They'll be relegated to the museum. Just the same as today, you go into a museum and see suits of armour. They were valid five, 600 years ago in time of war, but of course, later on, it'll just be a complete encumbrance, a handicap. So you cannot have the common ownership of the means of exchange, and that indicates the muddle-headedness of the man who formulated Clause 4 of the Labour Party. A man called Sidney Webb, who was an out-and-out reformist. And in any case, even supposing that bit about exchange wasn't in Clause 4, supposing it just said to secure full fruits of the efforts for the working class to get the common ownership of the means of production and distribution. So what? I mean, have they ever done anything about it? Has anything the Labour Party ever done been aimed at bringing about the common ownership of the means of production and distribution? Of course not. What the Labour Party is interested in is not abolishing capitalism, it's interested in patching it up. It's interested in palliating the problems of capitalism. It's a reformist party. It wants to reform capitalism in various ways which it thinks were better than the present way. Clause 4 of the Labour Party, even if it didn't contain that bit of exchange, is a dead letter. It means nothing. And I can understand and sympathise with the likes of Gaitskell in the Labour Party way back in the late 50s, when after a third successive electoral defeat since the end of the war, he said, just as Bernstein had said, look, let's get rid of all this revolutionary rhetoric. Let's stop talking about revolution. For a reformist party, why don't we admit it? Gaitskell said, look, we're not ever going to bother about bringing about the means of the common ownership of the means of production distribution, he said. What we are is a reformist capitalist party. And let's admit it. Let's jettison Clause 4. Of course, all the left-wingers were up in arms. And to keep them appeased, the idea was dropped. Because after all, a lot of them are the people that do the necessary foot-slogging that's got to be done in order to keep people like Gaitskell in their prominent positions. So they let it drop. But it was quite right. The Labour Party shouldn't get rid of that clause because it's a dead letter and it means nothing and it's wrong anyway.
Are there any more questions or contributions?
No, because I've told them they can't have one.
Have you?